family, partners, and friends. What's happening, all you party people? It's already February. The good news is we get a bonus day this year, the leap year. I think we all understand why we have a leap year. Earth rotates around the sun, 365 days, 6 hours, blah, blah, blah. Well, let's be careful. The actual rotation around the sun is 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 46 seconds. Therefore, the leap day doesn't exist quite to fix everything, and we need to adjust that by not adding a leap day in years divisible by 100. But why do we call it leap year? The actual term for inserting additional time in the calendar is intercalation, which apparently doesn't roll off the tongue as well. So we said, let's just call it leap year. Because in a normal year, your birthday moves one day forward. However, in a leap year, it leaps a day forward and skips it. Nonetheless, it's still not what bothers me about February. What bothers me about February, and I'm glad that you asked, is why did we decide that February would only have 28 days, whilst the rest of the months have at least 30 or 31? It's more to do with history than anything. The initial calendar had 10 months, and the Romans then had a long period of time of what they called winter, which they didn't really even want to put into months. Eventually, that didn't work out well for them, so they tacked on what is now January and February, and then they aligned it with the sun, and then they added a leap day. Anyway, this is Andy Erickson, your host of the award-winning Smart Acid Podcast, and I'm here with the sweet distillate to my catalytic cracking. He is the light thermal distillate to my coking. It's the heartbreaker, Chris Ernst. Heartbreaker, my man. How you holding up?
Awesome. Andy, how are you?
I'm doing all right. That's great. Did you know that the probability of being born on leap year is 1 in 1,461 days?
My uncle was born on February 29th.
Those odds aren't too crazy if you really think about it. Anyway, we have a fantastic show for us today, so let's get at it and give it a tasty. We have a ridiculously great guest on the show today. We're going to bring in Univar Solutions' very own Chef Mike, who is the lead culinary food development specialist, to talk a little shop about what's going on in the ingredient market. Chef Mike, man, welcome to Smart Asses Pod. How you holding up?
Heyo! Oh, I'm fantastic to be here. I'm usually in my kitchen bunker making the magic happen, but they let me out to come to the head office and do this, so I'm pretty excited.
Did you hear that, Heartbreaker? The head office? We're kind of big deals.
Still.
Still. All right. Before we get into this, Chef Mike, we have a little bit of a game that we'd like you to play. It's really to test your knowledge on the formal dining etiquette.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's I'll do my best. But being raised Chicago Polish, it's going to be I'm a meat and potatoes kind of guy, but I'll do my best to sound intelligent.
There's a lot to dig in on too on Chicago Polish compared to Chicago others, but let's just go to the game show. Let's get there.
Yeah.
It's multiple choice. First question. Most are aware of it being impolite to start eating before all at the table have been served. What is the exception to the rule? Is it A, if your dining group is larger than six? B, if a fellow guest grants you permission by saying, please go ahead before your food gets cold? C, if you're paying for the meal? Or D, there are no exceptions?
I would say B, if somebody who gives permission would be my go-to. But certainly, I'm usually the one, if I'm the last to get the food, please eat, eat, eat. But if I'm not, a lot of people will wait for me and I still, no, go ahead, please. So I go with B.
One for one.
Booyah!
We're off to a good start.
No goose egg across the board. I'm happy.
Hashtag winning. All right, question number two. Most know that in formal dinner settings, you use your forks from outside in. But do you know what the largest fork, often used for the dinner entree, is referred to? Is it A, middle fork, B, place fork, C, the devil's fork, or D, the big fork?
I always called it the dinner fork, so I don't think it's the devil's fork, although that would be amazing if it was. I think I'm going to go with, what was A? That was?
Middle fork.
I think we'll go with the middle fork because you could potentially have a dessert fork next to that or up at the top of your place setting. So I'm going to go middle fork.
One for two, Chef Mike. It's the place fork. The answer was B.
Interesting. Very interesting. I'm going to remember that now forever.
Number three. A dropped fork during formal dinner should not be picked up by a diner as it is considered unhygienic. What is the exception to the rule? A, if you pick it up within 5 seconds, the 5-second rule. B, if it might be stepped on or cause an accident. C, if you're able to quickly wipe your fork before placing it back on the table, or D, if it's the tiny fork used for lobsters?
Well, B for sure, as that is the anytime you want to avoid danger, hurting somebody, or any further illness or injury, that is probably the go-to. So I'm going to go with that.
All right. 2 for 3. Better than you already, Heartbreaker.
Yeah. Andy, follow-up question. What's the name of the tiny fork used for lobsters?
That is called the lobster fork.
Well, that's boring.
Yeah, well.
That can't be right.
I don't know what that's called either. I always call it the lobster fork too, so.
Or the caviar fork in the Erickson household.
Oh.
That's how we roll.
Highfalutin. All right, Chef Mike, you ready for the next one?
I hope so.
Here we go. True or false, you should never tell your fellow diners that you are going to the restroom.
I would say true, because that is something you don't necessarily want to discuss with your party, because then they're thinking about it. Just, you know, excuse me, I'll be right back, or something of that nature, but probably not any more detail as to what's going on. So I'm going to say, I think it's true. Don't tell your party that you're going to the restroom.
100% correct. Excuse yourself, but do not say why.
Huh. Then they're just going to talk about why, but that's fine.
Been 20 minutes. Where's our party member? Should we go on a reconnaissance mission, or what's the deal?
Gets a little uncomfortable if you don't tell people where you're going. I understand.
Especially for 20 minutes.
All right. Question 5. If a toast is being done in your honor, what should you absolutely not do? A, join the toast by raising your glass. B, make eye contact with the speaker. C, act surprised. Or D, say thank you.
I would say A. I believe it's kind of like applauding for yourself, which is, I don't believe, the proper protocol. Since it is in your honor, you got to sit there and take it, act surprised, happy, thank you. But I do not believe you participate in the toast as well.
That is correct. 4 out of 5. The Heartbreaker gets that one wrong quite often.
Yeah, routinely.
Routinely. All right, enough of this nonsense. Let's get into the good stuff. Chef Mike, talk to us. What is your background and how did you become a research chef?
Well, I grew up like many aspiring chefs, wanting to open my own restaurant. You know, I grew up cooking with mom and grandma and all that stuff. I was the one boy in the junior high school home ec class, so I can sew quite well as well. Very useful skills to have. Took culinary classes in high school, went to Johnson & Wales in Providence, Rhode Island. And while I was there, I quickly learned, you know what? I don't want to open up my own restaurant. I learned the chances of success, what that life is like. I worked in restaurants starting at 15 years old, did an externship in England working fine dining and all that stuff. So I ended up switching, well, not necessarily switching majors, but after 2 years of culinary, I got to choose my bachelor's in culinary nutrition. And that involved everything that's non-traditional working in a restaurant. So anything from being a registered dietitian to food scientist, product developer. And that really piqued my interest, also because I play guitar and I needed to play guitar in a metal band. So nights, weekends, and holidays, that's show night. All right. I can't be in the back, you know, sweating, cutting my fingers. I need to be up front melting faces. So I somewhat fell into the R&D world, but I mean, it was really understanding what the food science and product development side was. And that really piqued my interest.
Okay, Mike, I really, really want to dig into melting faces a bit more, but let's stay on official official job titles. Can you tell us a little bit more about your current role at Univar Solutions Foodology, please?
Absolutely. So I am the corporate chef and culinary development lead for Foodology. So a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years now, Univar Solutions rebranded the food ingredient division as Foodology by Univar Solutions to really separate the business from more of the general chemical side of the business. It's slightly, you know, different customer base, different marketing. So, you know, sometimes you're dealing with R&D professionals who are chefs. So if they think your company is solely chemical, there may be a little disconnect. I certainly, being in the industry, know how these things go. But with that rebrand, they also hired me to open up the first culinary-focused innovation center. Univar Solutions has a variety of solution centers across the globe. This was the first one that was culinary-focused. So there's two main functions. functions. It's either working with our suppliers on how to showcase their ingredients, or it's working directly with customers on providing solutions for issues they may be having. There's a lot of other fun little things we get to do, but me and Dylan Morton are rocking and rolling here in Chicago at the Hatchery, where our spot is, and we're just making the magic happen.
All right, enough preaching about Univar Solutions, how great we are. Let's talk a little bit about trends in food and the food industry. Particularly, let's spend some time talking about inflation and how that's spilled into the cost of food and the choices that people are making.
Inflation and world events will always directly affect food and consumers. Death, taxes, and eating are three of the things that everyone has to do no matter what. So whenever there are issues with inflation, it's almost that food and culture scenario where you can absolutely kind of take a evaluation of the world as a whole, and that will help inform you of things that are going on, how people are eating. So whether that is world events that make ingredients difficult to find or even obsolete, which means you are more than likely replacing that with a more expensive ingredient, usually, and whether that is just general inflation that is causing general ingredient costs to rise, which then will in turn make individuals cook more at home. We are getting to the point where even in the fast food world or QSR world, everything's getting a little more expensive. So people are actually more enticed to cook at home, because you can more affordably do that. The ingredients at a supermarket are at least currently a little less affected by inflation than kind of that restaurant world. And then there are obviously things that R&D, food manufacturers, food producers can do to deal with that. There's quite a few options, but certainly some other trends now are, let's say, healthy indulgence. We went through a period where everything's got to be free of sugar, fats, carbs, a lot of things everybody finds very delicious. And now we're reaching a point where, how about you let me eat the tasty thing, but maybe I just won't eat as much, or make it a little bit better. I don't need zero calorie, high protein pizza. I am not eating pizza for health benefit. I'm eating it because it's greasy and delicious. So maybe just make it a little better, or I'll fix, my portion sizes as I eat. So those kind of go hand in hand together.
So Chef Mike, you talked a little bit about producers or companies within the space. Like, what are manufacturers doing to become more efficient to curb costs? Like, what type, can you give us some examples of things they're doing?
I want to make sure to frame this as it's not right or wrong, because the business we're in, we service every type of customer in every industry, whether that is traditional meat, whether it's meat alternative or whatever it might be. So, a couple things a manufacturer can do is deal with efficiencies. Maybe it's as simple as you have 13 varieties of the thing you make. And every time you, change the line over or make another thing, it is a little less efficient than making one thing over and over again. So you could reduce the amount of SKUs or reduce the amount of formulas you make. And instead of 13, you now have your 6 or whatever. There are cost-cutting measures within a recipe or formula. So let's say, I think they've leveled off now, but egg prices were a great example where we received a lot of projects on how do we offset the increasing prices of eggs, whether people are switching to cage-free, organic, whatever it might be. So there may be some more affordable alternatives, like reducing the amount of egg in a recipe, replacing that with fibers or gums or, hydrocolloid systems or whatever, to offset that ingredient cost there. There's certainly things like food preservation methods that the longer something lasts, the less you would have to manufacture it because it'll be able to stay on a shelf longer. So you could work with modified atmosphere packaging. You can add preservatives. Maybe there's a different kill step or a heat method that will allow the food to last longer. We actually also sell enzymes that are used for not only, and I'm going to use some big words here, not only for food safety, but organoleptic evaluation of food products. That is taste, smell, you know, is the bread stale when you put it in your mouth? That's an organoleptic. You don't need data to support that. It's people's opinions on flavor or texture or things like that. So, I mean, those are a couple, but there are obviously multiple things you could do to reduce costs. But I think those are some of the main ones that a lot of food manufacturers will at least look at first in order to optimize what they're doing.
Fantastic, Chef Mike. So you mentioned healthy indulgence earlier. Can you help me understand what other trends you see from us as consumers in the food industry?
Absolutely. I mean, so we already touched on the big one of less people are going out to eat and are electing to eat at home more, which is causing less opportunities for restaurants to serve you. So there is a lot of technology to try to offset that. Use our app. XYZ Restaurant wants you to sign up and we'll give you all the deals that you want through the app. Just make sure to sign up for the app. Separate from that is now they have a direct link to you as a customer, can specifically advertise certain products or whatever to you to entice you to come to the restaurant one more time a week, one more time a month in order to deal with that. We obviously talked about healthy indulgence, so you're going to see that in almost every product category of, I don't want a sugar-free, high-fiber ice cream, just I want less of it. The hard part with that is then if it's based on portion size and control, you are now buying a lot of packaging along with your food item. So just be cognizant of how that affects environmental impact and things of that nature. And I think consumers, specifically in the U.S., are getting a little more adventurous with their flavors. However, they are looking for more authentic versions of that. I grew up eating tacos with the packet. It exists. I will not ever say that that is an authentic Mexican cuisine at all, not villainizing it at all, because many people eat in that scenario. But while people are looking for new adventurous flavors, they are doing their research to understand, is it authentic? Is it real? As well as even going as far as like what the company stands for, what's the story behind the company, and do I want to promote and be involved with XYZ brand for all of the reasons you would expect to hear on the internet, good or bad or indifferent. So all of those things very much factor into kind of shaping our food life at the moment.
All right, let's pivot a little bit here, Chef Mike. Allergies, food allergies in particular. Has things changed? Are we eating different? I mean, it just seems like it's a lot more prevalent now than it was when I was a kid 30 years ago.
A couple things can be happening all at the same time. Let's say proportionately, there are the same amount of people dealing with allergies as people around you were doing as children. Well, now proportionally, there are so many more people dealing with that due to the overall volume of humans in our country that now we are seeing it more and we're hearing about it more. We also are in a world where we have a lot more information about all of these types of allergies. So maybe your pal who kept getting sick back in the day didn't realize that they had a gluten allergy because that really wasn't known or understood back in the day. And now that there is a larger class of individuals that deal with it, it is now more of a focus. You also have to understand that a little separate, but a great example is vegetarian or vegan items on a restaurant menu. If you don't have enough vegetarian or vegan individuals going to your restaurant and eating those things, there will not be enough sales. It'll come off the menu. So maybe back in the day, there weren't enough people in the area to worry about a peanut allergy. However, now, knowing about allergies, knowing that there are so many more individuals in a location, it might make a lot more business sense to deal with it, to allow more consumers into your restaurant, more consumers eating your product or whatever it might be, because back in the day, it didn't make business sense, which in my opinion should be at the bottom of the list of, why you would want to do this. Certainly for business reasons, it should be more keeping people healthy and things of that nature. But now there's just a bigger group of individuals dealing with it. So we hear about it more. And if you want to make those sales, you either can choose to support that or if you want to decide that we are going to be a, you know, maybe you're a peanut butter manufacturer. Well, it'll be a little harder to get rid of peanuts in your ecosystem. So I think there's just larger groups and it makes more business sense and people know more about these allergies to deal with it.
All right, Chef Mike, let's bring her home here. If there's one takeaway from our conversation that you would like our listeners to have, what would that be?
For me, I would say do your own research and realize at least there are people out there in the food world that want you to have what you like and want the other people to have what they like. You know, we as a company not only service the Whole Foods consumer, so those who want all natural, organic, gluten-free, paleo, whatever it might, no artificial flavor, color, preservatives, we sell those kinds of ingredients into that world. We also sell the complete opposite, all the preservatives and texturants and flavors and things that go into the other side of the spectrum there. So when you are making your decision on whether or not you want to eat a thing, first thing is make sure it's from a credible source and not just random human on the internet who has influence. That's not necessarily a credible source. But also, there is no need to villainize a thing you may not like. It's okay that if, you know, for your family, for you, you have made these decisions, but making somebody else feel bad for the fact that they need to buy affordable meals, that's priority one, to get enough calories to feed their family. We are not in any world where we should be villainizing anybody for that choice. So just do your research. It's totally cool to want to eat a certain way for all of the reasons. You don't need to villainize somebody else for their choices. So that's just more, that's more of a Chef Mike thing. That's just how I roll. But yeah, so that would be my message.
All right, Heartbreaker, before we close this out, I want Chef Mike to talk a little bit about his television show that you're on, that you're leading.
Oh, yes. So I host a Dungeons & Dragons-related cooking show. It's on Plex and Amazon's Freevee channel, and it is based off of a cookbook called Heroes Feast. That is also the name of the TV show. And I did not write this cookbook at all. I got a call from a studio that was like, hey, we Google searched D&D Chef, and you popped up, because I do use social medias for all the all my side fun things and whatnot, some of which is very nerdy, video games and Dungeons and Dragons. One thing led to another, and there is a cooking TV show that exists with me hosting, which is so ridiculous, but very fortunate to be a part of it.
Wow, that's awesome, Chef Mike. Thank you for sharing. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks for bringing your energy and expertise to the podcast today. All right, everybody. That's a wrap on another episode of the Smart Acids. Thanks to all of our listeners, both loyal and those new to the pod. And thanks to Chef Mike for making this episode of the podcast extra tasty and organoleptic. Stay safe, stay healthy, and enjoy the coming of better weather.
Smart Acids. Breaking things down for the chemicals and specialty ingredients market, one boron at a time. Smart Acids is part of the Univar Solutions Podcast Network.